philosophers in
space.
Once again, this is Rumor Control. Here are the facts.
I was thinking of the immortal words of Socrates, who said, I drank what?
Mythology is one of the primary motivations for cultural development.
Maybe it is. What's that got to do with filming a play?
Exactly!
What does that mean?
I don't know!
We will solve our own problems as you commanded. The time has come to convert the unbelievers.
Hello and welcome to Philosophy. My button just said I was going to do this intro, so I don't want to do it.
You've given up already. I knew you were going to do that.
My button just said that you knew I was going to do that.
Yeah. See, I'm still motivated to make cracks about free will. I don't care about the button. It's still funny to me.
Okay. I guess I'll, for the sake of our listeners, I know I'm an automaton with no free will, but I'll still do it.
Just got to power through.
Welcome to Philosophers in Space, episode 110. That's a nice, cool number. I'm Thomas. That's Aaron. And this here's my garage door opener that tells me when I'm about to do something.
You make it sound like a Rick and Morty commercial.
It's now saying I just opened my garage door. Oh no, this is actually my garage door open. Okay, never mind. I don't know why I lost all in faith and free will. Turns out it was just my garage door opener. It wasn't even a special magical device.
Garage doors raise doubt for me about the existence of free will. I could see that. Aren't we all just garage doors opening and closing?
Yeah, the door never has a choice. Go up, go down.
Just like us.
Although I feel like my garage door does have a choice. Like the amount of times I have to push the button before it actually decides to get up off its ass and open or close is a lot more than one.
I mean, according to Daniel Dennett, as long as your garage door is like sufficiently advanced, it does in fact have a choice. So there you go.
Sort of what he would say.
You should respect the moral agency.
You're never going to believe this, folks. I got Aaron to read a book. And that book, well, no, I apologies. I got Aaron to read half a book. He still hasn't finished it because he's not a big reader. But...
it's so called Exhalation. Get it all out now. Anathem's coming up soon. It's fine. Here's
the
story,
folks.
I will
be missing when that happens.
Here's what happened. Thomas has been begging me to do Daniel Dennett because he's a giant Daniel Dennett nerd.
Free will is more actually, but yeah.
Yeah, sure. But especially Daniel Dennett's compatibilism. You have clearly a special love for Daniel Dennett's compatibilism. And so I am treating him to that with positive reinforcement because he did the good thing and read the spider book that I told him to read. And so we get to do the spider book here soon. So it's a win-win for everybody, even though none of us have free will.
I feel like I've read most of what you've asked me to read, just not 400 hour.
Everything except Anathem. You're right. It's pretty much 100% of things that aren't Anathem.
And I will not be reading Anathem. Sorry. If it was a 8 hour read, I would do it. But it's like 45 hours. I'm not doing it. Sorry.
Fine. You can lead a fid to water, but you can't make them drink.
Yeah. But Aaron finally read a book, and one of the short stories in this collection of short stories called Exhalation is called What's Expected of Us. And, we'll have the link. It's really short. You can read it really quickly. So if you'd like to do that, it's not really major spoiler or anything. So I wouldn't even worry about it. If you don't want to, we can explain it in about the same time it'll take you to read it. So that's our,
probably
book we're talking about today. And then definitely faster.
We'll do it a second ahead of when you're reading it, actually.
And we're also going to talk about free will. And Aaron really loves Dan Dennett, so he's going to talk about that.
Yeah, I don't usually like talking about free will, but like really, Thomas has just been nonstop, like obsessed with us talking about free will. So I'm like finally fine with just no.
Yeah, I was like, hey, Aaron, should we talk about the most popular debate, especially among people who aren't actually philosophers, a debate that people love to talk about for hours and hours, and it's one of the most important philosophical topics? And he said, yeah, let's do half an episode on that and then 9 more Dune episodes. And then...
Hey, Aaron, why don't we just drop in a casual conversation on Dennett on free will? That's not a hard one for you to take a solid swing at, is it? None of your reputation is going to be on the line when assessing this particular material.
Definitely dense. Definitely not an easy read.
But predictable. Whatever. That's important.
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
All right, let's hop into Brian's already doing it because his beeper is actually 2 minutes ahead. So he probably already. Anyway, let's hop into the exposition zone.
Mm-hmm.
Punch it. Okay, so this is just a short little story that's framed as a letter from the future, because in the future they have time travel, and of course where else would you have it but the future. And it's a letter saying, hey, there's a new device that you may have heard of. It's like a garage door opener, except it just has a light, and the only thing it does is it's fitted in with these, like, some sciencey language to be able to read a second into the future. And it just turns on the light a second before you push the button. And no matter what you do, no matter how hard you try, you cannot beat the system. There's no way to do it. So you try to, like, do a thing where you're like, well, I'm going to wait till it flashes and then I won't push the button. Well, it just will never flash. So you can't beat it that way. And if you try to do, like, a quick fake out thing, you know, no matter what you do, the light always flashes exactly a second before you push the button. And you just cannot avoid it. It's 100% rock solid. And so the letter from the future is framed as saying essentially, hey, just pretend you still have free will, because what happened in this dystopia, I don't know if there's Terminators running around or what, but it's in the future, it's not good. Civilization is not in great shape, because a bunch of people, like a third of people, upon realizing they have no free will, or according to them, their interpretation of this, And using these garage door openers, just quit living. They just, like, sit around comatose, don't do anything, don't feed themselves, because they don't think there's any point to it. And so this letter from the future argues, you know, it's just pretend you have free will. Like, no matter what, it seems like no matter what, just keep living as though you do, because civilization depends on that. And then. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Anything else I missed? Any details you want to cover?
No, I think that's pretty much the gist of it. And I think it's a fun little piece, and it dovetails, yeah, I think, beautifully with our discussion of devs. So I'm happy that you brought it to my attention in the way that you did.
I just want to note, this is, like, not even my seventh favorite story in the Ted Chiang book. So make sure you read that book, because it's the stories are really good. There's some great ones that I hope Aaron will get to. And, you know, if he ever decides to read something, he'll get to it. And, you know,
he'll finish it right after this episode, as soon as we're done recording. it is. There's been a lot of good ones in that collection, and it's been nice to work through that material. So, yeah, I think that's the main points. And then, since we're going to talk about Dennett, before we really dive into his theories, I think it'd be interesting to, you were talking a little bit before about doing some analysis of how would Dennett critique or, you know, be in favor of this particular paper, because I think there are, or short story rather, right? Because I think there are parts of this that are on point for things that he does agree with. So there is stuff that he would like about it, as well as, I think you're right, there's stuff that he would be critical of here.
I'm curious to hear what you think he would like about it. I think we can be quite certain, based on, you know, the books I've read and the lectures I've watched of him, that he would think this is nonsense, because merely being predictable does not render you without free will. And I think he makes a very direct comparison. And this short story is from 2005, by the way, originally. So it probably, who knows what would have come first or whatever, but I think Dennett's been working a long time. But anyway, those experiments Libet, I think.
Yeah, the ones where they read your reactions.
Yeah,
they
essentially can read your choice from your brain data about whether you're going to pick, you know, one option or another option a little bit ahead of time. It takes a while to crunch the numbers. Like, they can't do it in real time because, you know, takes a lot of processing and stuff, but like they're able to, with better than chance accuracy, not 100%, better than chance accuracy, tell from your brain data which thing you're going to choose before you choose it. And Dennett thinks that says nothing about free will, really. Mm-hmm. So, or it does, it certainly doesn't negate free will as he understands it. So I think, therefore, it's pretty clear that he would think this story is similar. Like, it's functionally the same thing. I mean, the button is knowing what you're going to do, or the little LED light is knowing what you're going to do a second before you do it. I don't think it necessarily, even, by the way, even not under Dennett's interpretations of free will, I'm not mm-hmm. entirely sure this tells you anything. Like, all this tells you is if you buy into the idea in the story that such a device could look a second into the future, I mean, I guess it just tells you that determinism is true, right? And, mm-hmm. I mean, and possibly some sort of weird time travel. But does that, I don't think it's news to most people who have done any casual reading or anything on free will that determinism is likely real, right?
Well, what the point is,
be news to anyone?
One of the points they raise in the paper is it doesn't matter how much you've heard the theories of determinism. Like, we all, you know, we're all sort of roughly familiar at this point with the theories for why we might have doubt about free will. And as the paper says, those doubts have never been like sufficiently gotcha. Resolved, but it's the proof of it. It's the physical evidence of it in the form of this clicker that like really puts people's minds over the edge. So it's really a psychological harm, right? And that side is the part that I think you're mostly right about sort of Dennett being skeptical, broadly speaking, of empirical evidence proving the idea of free will. Now, on the predictability thing that you pointed out there, I think he is a little bit more like, he does, I think, believe that part of what we care about when we care about ascribing free will is we care about unpredictability. And so there might be a concern that if you expanded this machine from just, you know, knowing whether you're going to click the button to knowing everything you're going to do in the future, that could actually raise problems for his account of free will. And I want to talk about that.
I don't think
some.
So. I disagree with that, but we can.
Yeah, well, we can dive that. Into that. Some,
I think he's
right.
saying what we want out of our experience of free will and what we feel we need and why we defined it the way we have. I think he's saying we want to be unpredictable to other agents, but right. I don't think that it follows that his definition of free will depends on being unpredictable.
Well, it's tricky because his definition of free will is a practical definition. It's not a theoretical definition by his own account. He denies the existence of libertarian theoretical free will. He agrees that he basically concedes what the metaphysical side of this argument to folks like myself who claim that libertarian free will doesn't exist, and then takes up the objection that we don't need the libertarian free will in order to get what we need out of free will arguments.
Can you go ahead and define, this is what drives me nuts about this, mm-hmm. with apologies, and I think it will be a good question to start, is just defining what you mean by libertarian free will, because I firmly believe this, that it is a nonsensical thing. And that it's not just Dennett trying to say, well, I know this is some great definition that we all wish we had, but let me switch that out for something different, and then I'll call that free will. Like, it's literally nonsensical to me, and maybe you can absolutely change my mind, but it seems like a totally illogical, even contradictory thing, this libertarian free will that people say they want.
To me, the most important feature that I think is there for libertarian free will would be the one that Nagel's talking about in the Moral Luck paper back when we did Good Place, the control condition, right? To say that you have free will is to say your actions are under your control in a sufficiently robust kind of way. And I think there is a reasonable way to distinguish, you know, to talk about the idea of your actions being under your control or not. We can talk about cases where it is clearly not under your control. And then I think there's a reasonable argument that, like, ultimately nothing is under your control. And even whether you have the kind of free will that Dennett claims we have or don't, for each individual depends on whether or not, depends on factors beyond their control. So I don't think that and that it is this control condition that is to me fundamental and essential for things like moral responsibility. And so I don't think that his alternative account of free will is necessarily going to work. But so for me, the libertarian account of free will is the you have control over your actions in the sense that they are not the result of luck. And I think every one of our actions is fully the result of luck. So that to me is the problem that I don't think Dennett can solve. Does that seem incoherent to you? Or does it just seem sucky?
No, I'm trying to translate it over. I think that's a great way to phrase that. I just think that like a result of luck is another way of saying determined, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's like determined by prior causes or whatever.
Right.
And here's what gets me. When people talk about libertarian free will, especially, and you're not doing this, but especially from a religious context,
mm-hmm.
they are trying for something magical that can't exist. You know, like there's the quote that Dennett frequently uses where he says, you know, if free will is like, I think it's from Jerry Fodor or whatever, where he mm-hmm. says, free will is like, you're like Eve about to, you know, bite from the apple and not even God can know which thing you're going to choose.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be right that I won't be able to properly channel a very, very brilliant philosopher and Dennett to answer your objection well. Uh-huh. But I think that objection is what really bothers me with some people want that version of free will. And that to me is what's incoherent. Because if you're talking about, let's put aside for the moment, you know, the fact that God doesn't exist, but we'll substitute in God, you know, instead of God, it's some all knowing, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, being that has access to every fact of the matter, you know, and to define it such that even some sort of outside being or whatever with access to every single fact of the matter wouldn't be able to know what you're going to choose strikes me as not even something, if you break it down, it's not even something you would want.
Yeah, well, so
what in your mind would you want to be happening to make that decision?
That's,
you know, like,
yeah, so I think this is why I want to be really careful and like stick to not conflating different criteria here, because to me, the control condition is very different from predictability. So on my view, we lack libertarian free will. Even, you know, no matter what is true about the predictability or unpredictability of our behavior from any given perspective, it's not an issue of predictability to me. And so I'm agnostic on any of those kinds of predictability kinds of questions, because I don't think that's what it's at issue here. And so, like, in a sense, I to some extent agree with Dennett that, like, predictability is not the most important feature. It's the control condition. And so you brought up the Eve example, and I want to me, what is right about the Eve analogy is not whether or not God could predict Eve's behavior, but that like Eve is meant to signify a kind of untouched freedom, mm-hmm. you know, of a like a personality like untouched by prior effects, essentially.
Yeah,
right?
Which is obviously still garbage.
But like it's impossible, right? Like that
is impossible.
And you're right.
Even
to say,
if you have an Eve that you create right now,
right.
Eve's brain has to have some firmware that, you know, would be what she was drawing on to make the choice.
But it can't simply be an objection to the free will deniers, right? That they are saying that they think that free will is something that doesn't exist and is impossible if they have a good reason.
Let me phrase the question this way.
Yeah.
Can you conceive of a type of being in any way? Like, what would be a being that could have the free will you're talking about?
I'm not sure that I can, and I'm not sure that necessarily...
That's the difficulty
me, that doesn't necessarily disprove the theory, because the control condition is coherent, and, like, the problem is coherent, and merely because I can't... I mean, like, I could say in principle, like, I can imagine what an entity like this would look like, is that it would be an entity that somehow has a robust will, but that robust will is in some way completely undetermined by prior events. And maybe such a thing is like physically possible.
I don't think it is.
But I think when you say incoherent, you make it sound like
it's contradictory.
Well, yeah, that's my point, right? Like the free will denier is saying the concept of free will that is essential for moral responsibility involves a fundamental contradiction. So the objection can't be.
So we agree. agree on that.
Right. And so the objection can't be you're simply saying that what we need is something that is contradictory, because I'm agreeing with you. What we need is something that is contradictory. But that's the problem with the people who believe that like moral responsibility persists on, you know, without any problems here. You know what I'm saying?
I would put it a different way, which is, and those are all great points. And I can tie in some more Dennett, because I'm a huge fan, and, you know, not that I'm the philosophy teacher, but another thing he talks about a lot that I find really interesting, and this applies to all of philosophy, it's not just this debate, but he has a pet definition. I can't remember who he quotes. You'll probably throw out the name. But the pet definition of philosophy in some respects is reconciling the manifest image with the scientific image, or something like that, which is to say, reconciling it, and there's a jokey quote version of it he uses that I love too, which is like, philosophers say, well, sure, it works in practice, but does it work in principle? That kind of thing. Like, so the idea of taking our manifest image, which is what we see and what we feel like is happening, you know, like our kind of folk understanding of what's going on, and reconciling it with the more hard science-y version of that.
Yeah.
And I really like that description of what's going on, because when I think about free will, I think what has happened, and I could be wrong, this is me speculating, but it seems as though humans have gotten a taste for a thing that is incoherent, or I'll use the word, sorry, maybe not incoherent, because you don't like that word, and I think you're right, maybe it's a bad word, maybe contradictory is better. They want, that humans want something contradictory, because we have an everyday experience that feels like something. So it's like, it feels like something, and I grab my cup of water right now, it feels like, well, that's a choice I'm making, it feels like that, and that's the feeling we've started with. And then as we've learned more about the world, it turns out that has made us want something that just doesn't exist. And to me, that doesn't mean that what Dennett's doing isn't valid. Like, what Dennett is doing is saying, here is a version, here's a definition of free will, which is closely tied with moral responsibility, which I think we should get to for Dennett. And that is a better definition of the thing, because the thing you want, by being contradictory, it's kind of useless to say you want it. You know, like, it's like if you said, no, I know that, like, when I see the color blue, I am seeing blue. And then a scientist is like, well, no, you're actually not. Like, it has to do with the wavelength of the blah, blah, blah. And they explain what color is. And you're like, no. I want you to give me an explanation that means I'm seeing the color blue in the way that feels the same as my saying it. You know what I mean? That's kind of what I feel like it's like.
Yeah. And this is the same dichotomy, the same split that Nagel is into when we talked about subjective and objective. That would, you know, when you're talking about the experiential side versus the objective scientific side, you're talking about the subjective objective divide. And the Moral Luck paper is one of the examples that Nagel gives of this fundamental divide, along with things like our subjective experience of consciousness versus the objective brain states. And as you know, Dennett is big into those kinds of issues as well. So, like, I'm totally with you that there is an apparent contradiction between our experience of the world and what science tells us is true about the world, and that is a real, that presents a lot of really hard problems. And I think that is absolutely true, and very important. And I'm all for folks like Dennett trying to present alternative accounts of things like free will that they think, you know, that they would say would acknowledge are deflationary to some extent, right, compared to the libertarian account, but still meet the necessary criteria in the important ways. And then my criticism is just, I think we should, like you said, get to his account and how it applies to things like moral responsibility, because I just think that what he offers up, while it is very, very valuable and important for how we understand things like coercion, how we understand things like competence, which he talks about in that video as well, like, that stuff is valuable, but it doesn't eliminate the problem of luck as I see it. So that's just, to me, like, both of those things can be true at the same time.
Yeah, no, I think he would also agree with that.
Possibly.
I think one problem is when a lot of people, and this is not just you, like, a lot of people do respond to his work this way, which is to say, but you haven't answered my libertarian free question, or, you know, you haven't answered my definition of free will. I think you would say, like, but I've already granted that, but it's not interesting. Like, if that's, well, but if that's where the debate is, like, either this account of free will is what it is or not, then it's like, okay, well, then not.
Well, that's why it's really important. It a little bit. But that's why it's really important for me to say the reason I think this account matters is because you can't hang moral responsibility on the weaker account. So it's not just...
Oh, I think you can.
Well, but that's so the there, point. That would that's be the debate, right? So what I'm saying is merely responding, oh, well, but you haven't answered, you know, like, it's not that I'm being, you know, just like irrational in demanding somebody answer my magical beliefs about free will. I'm saying... There's a reason the less developed, you know, like the less robust model doesn't do it. And that means that, like, you do need to answer my question about libertarian free will, because that's the model that is actually going to get you moral responsibility. But of course, you're right. That is the debate here. So let's talk about the criteria that he presents for having free, having his version of practical free will, right? And he says that this is supposed to be a political slash practical doctrine, that, like, this is about how human beings treat each other in practice, he says.
Yeah.
And the two main ones that I think are really important that we should talk about are competence and predictability, right? So he talks about predictability in this, and he talks about we want to be seen as unpredictable as entities because, and this ties into stuff that we've talked about with him before back when we did AI and we got to the intentional systems theory, right? We want to be seen as intentional entities, right? Entities that have to be analyzed from the intentional stance. And in order to be analyzed in that kind of way, we need to not be so predictable that we can be easily analyzed from the design stance, right? So in a sense, right, you want to be unpredictable in a way that my laptop is not unpredictable, because that unpredictability gives you an air of personhood that you want me to recognize and respond to in our political climate. Do you feel like that's at least a fair account of how he incorporates predictability and unpredictability into this?
Gosh, I'm actually not sure, but I think I'll have to just go with it.
Okay.
Because I don't at this point, I saw the predictability thing, that point that he makes, as less of a focus than maybe you have. Like, mm-hmm. I thought that was more an accounting for why people have the intuitions they have, not as like a bedrock of his definition of free will or anything. So, but I'll put that aside and I'll go with you.
Yeah. And I just think it's important, not just because that was our short story topic, but that, like, I have doubts about the sort of takeaways he has on this particular front, which seem to imply that if somebody was fully predictable, like if we built a clicker machine that allowed me to predict more than just whether you're going to click the button, and thereby, you know, moved you in my categorization from an intentional system, like, down to a designed system, because I could sort of fully predict your behavior as a designed biological machine or something like that, I don't think that should have any implications for your moral status. But it seems like on his view,
either.
His view seems to tie moral status to the intentional stance in this way, though.
I don't think it does, for the very reason that I said, he doesn't think the Libet experiments have any effect on whether or not someone has free will.
Well, but I think there's just an inconsistency here, that I think that, like, he does think that some empirical information has implications in certain ways. He just thinks that those particular studies don't have, because, like, there's other stuff where he does draw on empirical claims in this lecture. He makes the empirical argument, and this is the other thing that I thought earlier that he would actually like about the short story, was he seems to buy into the ideas towards the end that if you convince people that they don't have free will, it will change their behavior and they will act worse as a result. So he does seem sympathetic to that kind of notion, which I'm sort of fairly skeptical about still at this point.
Sure, but that would be a different point than saying being predictable would convince you don't have free will. Those would be two different points.
Sure, right,
like
absolutely.
If you convince someone they didn't have free will by any other means, it would be the same.
Yes, and I'm not saying they're necessarily connected. I just think that in his mind,
Think I kind of see this a little differently than you do. But we'll have to set that aside to go on.
And then the other side besides the predictability side that he talked about in this paper was the competence one. And that he like tried to give an account of competence, especially the idea of could have done otherwise, where he brings up this thought experiment of two chess playing robots. And you feel like you, it sounds like you maybe you understand this or are more in tune with this thought experiment than I am.
This is a very in-depth thing. I can't believe we're already at minute 28 trying to like do. But there's a really interesting component to this, because one definition people use for free will sometimes, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the ability to have done otherwise. Like, I want to be able to say I could have done otherwise. Mm-hmm, that's critical. And actually, I remember in my college course that my I think one of two philosophy courses I took, that was, I think, how the professor presented it, was like, you want to feel like there, or at least one component of the definition of free will is feeling like you had the ability to do otherwise. And what Dennett does with this thought experiment, I think pretty brilliantly, is show that it's not about conditions exactly as they were, which, you know, because determinism would tell you, like, when I, he brings up this example that another philosopher had of a missed putt, you know, in golf, like you're putting a short putt and you miss it. And you want to feel like, I could have done otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And then this philosopher says, I don't want to know that I could have done otherwise in a similar putt or tomorrow when I have a similar putt or whatever it may be. I want to know that I could have done otherwise in exactly the same circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And his point is like, well, no, that's a nonsensical question. You can't do it differently in exactly the same circumstances. Just like if and actually, maybe because it'll take too long to explain or we can leave it for a later date. There's a way simpler analogy or thought experiment of like, if you're driving a car and he's like, this car is going 60 miles an hour. Could it go 70 miles an hour? The answer is like, yes, but could it go 70 miles an hour in exactly the same circumstances? And you're like, well, no, because I have to push down the accelerator to go 70. You know, like, he has a shorter version that shows you, like, you're not really interested in precisely every variable being the same, but could the car go 70? That doesn't really make sense. You want to know, could the car go 70 in, you know, close to the same circumstances? Is it capable of it? Does it have that competence?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, well, yes. Or maybe, you know, hypothetically, there's a block under the accelerator and you just cannot go. Like, those are two very different cars. And you want to know the answer to that. Like, that's valuable information as a human, in the same way that oftentimes in our actions, that's valuable information. And it's his point, I think, and I do want to do the chess thing, maybe. I don't know if it's a good After Dark topic or if it's a future episode, but regardless, he draws the point that, like, it's not important to know whether you could have done differently in exactly the same circumstances. I think because, in my mind, if determinism is true, that's a nonsense question. Like, no, if determinism is true, you rerun that and every time you will do the same thing. But it is valuable information as humans for us to know, well, what about very similar circumstances? What are you likely to do? Like, what is your competence? What is your, if are you the kind of person who would make that putt 9 out of 10 times? And so this was an anomaly, you know, like, we should expect you to do it. Or are you the kind of person who just can never make a putt? Like, it's not possible for you to make that putt. That's valuable information.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot here, and we are past time. And I know you're gonna hate me for saying this, but
it's almost like we should do more episodes on this topic, Aaron.
Yeah, maybe we need to do another episode on Dennett.
We even left the exposition took like 5 minutes.
I know. And we still I know. Well, so I'm pondering another show that maybe we can tie into some of my other concerns. Well, like, I want to continue this part of this, but there was another piece to that lecture about the practical enforcement, the public enforcement of free will as a concept that worries me a great deal. And I think there's an anime, I think it's called Psychopass, that might be a good one to toss into the mix here as well, to maybe elucidate some of the potential concerns that I might have with that framework.
Sure. Can I throw in, because there will be, I think, a quick example that I like a lot that he uses that might at least help people get thinking about your moral responsibility question.
Okay.
Which is, he asks, I guess he would ask his students this in one of his classes or something. He would say, what characteristics would a robot need to have for you to sign a contract with it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really interesting way of framing the question. Like, even if we, you know, maybe we disagree on what it means or something, but it's interesting to think about. Like, what if you just got a robot, like what would you need this robot to have? Like what characteristics, what qualities would you want to have to sign a contract or, you know, I don't know, a business deal or buy a house from it or something?
How big a business deal?
Yeah, exactly. Well, assuming it's significant, you know, you would want it. I don't know, just loosely speaking, like from my instinct is, you know, you would want it to be able to feel consequences. Like if it screws you, you know, like you wouldn't want it to be a robot that has no concern for you or what it does. And also furthermore, feel no consequences. You would want it to be able to be subject to some kind of punishment if it doesn't. And that doesn't mean like a, you know, like a violent punishment. That could mean, you know, forfeiture of important robot assets. Like, but it would have to be something that's important to the robot.
Does the robot like, have to be sentient? As a result, like,
I actually don't know if that's true.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what impact it has on the arguments. I don't think Dennett gets into that.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of just signing, similarly to I would say the same thing about us talking about any entity. Like when we talk about Data, when you meet Data on a planet and you don't know what it is, you basically treat him as sentient. And it's not entirely important whether he is or not if you can't tell, is it?
What I talk about with my students about this is I think if like an alien robot shows up and it acts sentient and you like have no knowledge of how it was built, then you are justified and morally obligated to treat it as if it is sentient. So I think in that kind of situation, you definitely give the benefit of the doubt to the entity.
Yeah, I think the important point, if I'm trying to channel Dennett again, I think the important part would be you need to feel certain or at least reasonably certain, however this might happen, that the robot cares about what happens to it in a way, like it cares about consequences. And, you know, I think you can set sentience aside. Actually, that'd be an interesting discussion. I don't know that it would need to be sentient. You would just need to feel very sure. And, you know, no human interaction is ever, you know, if I do a contract with Aaron, I'm never like 100% sure that's not going to be a horrible idea.
Not even close.
Yeah, no, like maybe 50%. Way off. But like, you can be reasonable. Like if you meet a person that you don't know, and people do this all the time, we have transactions with strangers all the time. You meet a person, they seem like a human, you know, like, you know, they see, okay, this looks like a person who cares about their reputation. They care about if they're going to screw me over, they might care about a criminal penalty of some kind. You know, they might care about a fine. They might care about having to go to jail for a month or something, or having, you know, you want to feel like they have some stakes. And that's how I think Dennett starts to work toward moral responsibility in that way. It might not be a way that you like, but I think it's interesting. And again, it doesn't come with certainty. Like you can meet someone, think you know all those things about them, and then they're a total psychopath who doesn't care and they might screw you over. But like, that's kind of how humans work. There's a risk in all that stuff.
Yes, I think that is all good points that we will save for our follow-up episode that we are clearly going to do. Ooh, involving psychopaths and such.
Awesome. Yeah.
Speaking of...
Okay, well, there's so much more to talk about After Dark. We're going to have to try to, like, you and I will have to try to keep track of what we talk about After Dark and not, like...
Yeah, I'll stick to people miss out light on stuff about the short story and things like that. And,
okay. Sure.
So I also wanted to, just before we run out of time here, I want to toss out, since you mentioned psychopaths, in a previous episode, I think I made an offhand comment, or one of us made an offhand comment at some point about schizophrenia and multiple personality disorder, which I should have known better is not like an accurate connection at all, that multiple personality disorder, or I think they have new terms for it now, dissociative identity disorder or something like that, is a very different thing than schizophrenia, and I shouldn't have equated those two. And I just wanted to issue a formal correction on that one, because it's a bad conflation that has caused substantial harm to people with schizophrenia.
Oh, I have no memory of that, but it's probably one of my other personalities was there at the time, because I'm schizophrenic, so that's probably why.
Thank you for undoing my apology with your terrible joke.
Render your apology meaningless.
Thanks. Tried to do a nice thing.
Like apologizing for blackface while wearing
blackface. Okay, you don't have the free will. I can't really hold you morally responsible for your terrible choices.
Yeah, according to you, doesn't matter. What are you going to do to me?
Yeah, lock you up.
You're going to want Dennett's compatibilism when you want to hold me morally accountable, Buster.
That's right. Nobody we'll believes in free will until somebody's attacking them, and then they want the free will cops.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to talk After Dark. That'll be fun. And apparently we get not one, but two episodes on one of the biggest philosophy topics from a philosophy show. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, because we haven't done any free will before. None at all.
Did we? I actually don't remember.
The moral luck paper is pretty much a paper about free will. That's fine. Oh, okay. I will crush you with it more in the
part
two.
We can talk about, that's also stuff we can talk about after dark. Anyway, patrons, hop on. It'll be so fun. Or sorry, non-patrons, become a patron. Hop on the After Dark. It'll be lots of fun. If not, it's okay. We'll see you next week. And patrons, we'll see you. We got to do our normal thing. Because you already did the preview, so that threw me off. But we do need to have our patrons make you say stuff this week.
Yeah, thanks to our 25-tier strong AI patrons, Chad T, Dude, Jesta O, Corey Ebert, Winchester's Never Die, I Picked a Hell of a Pandemic to Quit Drinking, Alex Arnett, and of course, Anathem. And most of all, top tier, all the util thanks to our $50 tier patrons, Sam Buck and No Commute, So Behind on Podcasts. We miss you. Catch up when you can. Thank you all so much.
And you did the preview that we're doing more free will. So that part is done. And that's all, folks. We'll see the patrons after dark. We'll see everybody else next time.
That's all for the main show, but if you'd like to go to patreon.com/0G, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
Whoa. Wait, no. You keep assigning me a world in which I don't punish people. I'm for practical punishment, right? It's a separate question about whether they actually deserve the punishment. I don't think anybody deserves the punishment.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/0G. You can find us on Twitter at @0GPhilosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.